TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. War, Peace and Climate Change, Questions and Answers, with Professor Michael Clare. In last week's TUC Radio program, Professor Clare gave a talk in preparation of the upcoming COP21 conference in Paris in December 2015. He said,
"The 21st Conference of the Parties is being billed as a climate or an environmental conference, but I hope to demonstrate tonight that it is also a peace conference, perhaps one of the most important peace conferences in human history."
And he followed that up with a well-crafted line of arguments. He spoke at the annual dinner of the Chicago Area Peace Action on October 24, 2015. And when he had finished, a lively back and forth began that so engaged everybody that the organizers had to stop it after 45 minutes, or it might have gone way into the night. Michael Clare has written and taught on U.S. military policy, international peace and security affairs, the global arms trade, and global resource politics. Even though he's not a climate scientist, he has carefully studied the current literature and made it part of his teaching and writing. He is convinced that climate change has already led to chaos and migration, with looming conflicts over resources. For many in the audience, this may have been the first time that they received a climate warning about the immediate risk from unexpectedly fast melting polar ice caps. Professor Clare made a very convincing case about the need to dramatically limit fossil fuel use and keep warming below 2 degrees Celsius. An audience member stood up and said, "We were worried about climate change before your talk. Now we're really scared. How is this going to play itself out at the conference?"
We have to mix the hope with the despair. So in the case of the Paris talks, there will be an agreement. I'm reasonably optimistic that it will be a pretty good outcome. To this, I have to say we should have some admiration for our president, President Obama, because he understood that this would not work unless he got China on board. You know, that's why I say this is a peace process as well as an environmental process, because we're not getting along with China on other issues. But he made it a priority to bring China into this conversation. And he got a pledge from China to come to Paris with a promise to agree to take steps to make it possible. So that gives us hope that something will occur. He's also put a lot of pressure on the number three country in this regard, which is India, because India is now soon will be the third biggest emitter of carbon dioxide and will be increasingly bad in the future. And Prime Minister Modi happens to be a real problem. He wants to build more coal plants. So President Obama has worked very hard on him. He's made some headway. So I think there's reasons to be hopeful. I'll tell you, my impression is that what will be achieved will be not enough to keep warming below 2 degrees centigrade, although it will be the best agreement ever reached before. Remember that the last time people agreed was the Kyoto Protocol. That was 20 years ago, and that excluded India and China and the developing countries. This one is all-inclusive. Everybody has to agree. So that's progress. I don't think they're going to make the 2-degree limit this time around. So the key thing to be looking at is the follow-up. Will there be a requirement that this be reviewed year after year, that the measures have to be ratcheted up as the temperature warms. If that's the case, this could prove to be a milestone in human history. That's why I say this will be the center of our work, I believe, in the years ahead.
The next question came from those with more confidence in local efforts. Can you give us a couple of examples for local or national action? In a moment, you will hear Michael Clare praise the California Cap and Trade Program. In all fairness, I want to add that many Californians prefer carbon taxes to cap and trade. Michael Clare.
Thank you for asking that, and I will accept criticism for not doing more of that. I'm trying to watch for that as best I can. But there is a lot happening, and probably it's more at local level than at national level. So California, I don't know if you're following California, is moving as if the federal government doesn't exist, so that California will abide by the 2-degree limit in terms of restricting emissions, promoting and providing incentives for green technology. And they now have, under Governor Brown, a green foreign policy. Like I say, they're acting as if the federal government doesn't exist. So they have established a cap and trade program with British Columbia. They're negotiating with Quebec and Ontario, as well as other states of the Union, to participate in their climate change control program. That is a very positive sign. And it's important to highlight that because the denialists, so-called, all say, and the Republican candidates all say, that the measures that President Obama favors will hurt the economy. You know, they call these a job-killing activities. But California is actually doing very well economically, even though it has the strictest emissions control in the United States. So we have to highlight that the greener you are, my state, Massachusetts, is also very high on that list, and our economy is doing very well. To highlight the fact that embracing green technology is a positive for the economy, and those states that are adhering to coal and oil are doing very badly. And those differences will increase over time. But in addition to that, wherever you look, there are towns that are adopting, local communities that are embracing, sometimes they're called transition towns, to reduce their footprint. And now colleges and universities are doing that. My college is going to become 100% solar powered in the next year. And we're growing our own food. And more colleges are doing this. So the Sierra Club magazine each September publishes a guide to the coolest colleges. So if you have children or grandchildren thinking of looking at college, get that issue instead of the U.S. News and World Report. And it ranks colleges by their commitment to green technology, to eliminating carbon. And it's now becoming a race to be on the top of that list. So those are some examples. Thank you.
The governor of the Bank of England recently gave a talk about the systemic risks of fossil fuels. Someone in the audience asked Professor Clare if he had seen the talk and wanted to comment.
He said that simply as a matter of risk, if you're a prudent banker or investor, you have to worry about risk. And the risk from climate change was growing exponentially. Hence, if you were wise, you would do everything you could to minimize your exposure to climate change, which means the countries should do everything they can to curb their fossil fuel consumption and switch to renewables. But he spoke in particular about the insurance industry, as you said, because he calculated that the insurance industry will go bust in another decade or so because of the magnitude of storm damage and fire damage and the like. And this has created a ruckus in England because he's part of the conservative government, which is made up of people who are anti-climate action. Cameron's government is pro-fracking and anti-wind power and solar power. So it really has created quite a ruckus. And the good effect is that it is adding more momentum to the divestment movement, and more large pension funds and investment funds are taking their money out of fossil fuels. So it's having a very positive effect. I'm glad you're asking me all these questions. The more, the better.
Professor Michael Clare. Here's a question that still comes up. Does nuclear power play any role in a transition away from fossil fuels?
I've read the technical reports from the International Energy Agency, the IEA in Paris, which is the leading think tank of the industrialized nations. It's not an environmental organization. And they advocate nuclear power as an option. But they say that to make the progress that we need to make, nuclear power can only provide a small fraction, a wedge, they call it, of the transition that's necessary. And it's too slow because of all the problems with nuclear power, the permitting for it, the problem with disposal of the radioactive wastes. It's expensive to get started, but it takes a very long time. It takes 10 to 15 years to just break ground and another 15 years to complete a plant. And those 30 years before a plant comes online, we have to move much more swiftly than that. So yes, it might have a wedge role in some countries. A wedge by meaning, you know, if you eliminate fossil fuels, you're going to have to replace it with stuff. So some is wind, some is solar, geothermal, wave power, and nuclear power and hydropower will all be wedges. But nuclear is not going to be a large wedge.
An audience member expressed her frustration that it is impossible to have a national conversation on climate change because the media are not responsive. And she wanted to know if the Defense Department ever gets concerned about climate change.
That's an interesting question. I mean, certainly what you say about the media is critical. And I know you try to work on the media, and this is something that has to be a multi-generational effort, because I know from conversations with my students that they don't read the things that I read. They get everything off the internet. And Twitter and all of that, Facebook. So I'm sure you're trying to reach people and those media as well. And it's crucial to operate at every level to educate people. So that's one point. The Defense Department is very interesting. I spoke this year at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis. And I didn't give the same speech, but I made some of the same points. And there was total agreement with everything I said, because they understand that the world that I described is the world in which the cadets are going to be on ships dealing with these crises. And they told me they believe that they're going to spend their time in humanitarian missions or policing failed states because of climate change and resource catastrophe. So they understand completely everything that I told you tonight. And they're deeply troubled by this. And I've spoken to senior military officers, and they believe that this is the world in which they're going to have to operate. And therefore, the military is ahead of every other government agency in terms of planning for this world, in terms of being able to operate There's a good side and a bad side to everything. The good side is that they're pioneering new technologies that could be available in the civilian sector. They're building ships and planes that could fly with biofuels, algae-produced biofuels. That might someday prove very useful. You know, on the other hand, they want to develop these systems so they could fight wars in the future, even when oil is not available. So that's the story about the Defense Department. They take climate change very, very seriously, and they see a world in which U.S. allies, I name some of them, Kenya, Nigeria, are likely to be failed states, and they may be sent there, in humanitarian or police operations. Oh, by the way, this is the Navy, and most major U.S. naval bases are going to be underwater by the end of this century. So they are very aware that their whole operating system is at risk.
Why, a person in the audience wanted to know, are the human causes of climate change still being denied?
My belief is that there's no such thing as denial. There are people who, for political reasons, ideological reasons, or selfish reasons, choose to finance a professional class of denialists who profit from this activity. But I don't think that there are people anymore who are true denialists. We know, for example, in the past few weeks, investigators have, through careful search, have found out that ExxonMobil knew 20 years ago. Their scientists told them that climate change is real, that it's caused by humans, and that it's going to have these effects, and that ultimately they're going to have to stop burning fossil fuels, and they chose to suppress that information and went on saying there's no such thing as climate change. But that was profit-driven activity, not because they didn't believe. They knew. And I think that's true of all of these companies. They know. They just have selfish or political reasons for doing so. Now, some of this is ideological, because the president, who's a Democrat, who they hate and despise, is in favor of taking action on climate change. So anything that he says, they say the opposite. This is a kind of pathology. It's pathological.
The next question gave the exchange a different turn. The person mentioned the scientist and geographer Jared Diamond and his book Collapse. And he wondered if the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change ever considers the social science of climate change, not just degrees and parts per million.
Yes. In the IPCC report, the volume that I identified has a chapter on human security that addresses this question, social science. And they refer to the failed states that you refer to, the Mayans, the Anasazi of American Southwest, and others. I use that book in my class. We're in the middle of it now. And here's what I found. Maybe I should have talked more about this. Here's what I found in the book and in the social science research. Societies that work together, where people rally in the face of adversity across class lines, across race lines, across ethnic lines, that rally in the face of adversity survive. Societies that break apart, where the factions, different factions, fight with one another in the face of adversity, collapse. Human solidarity or social solidarity is the clue to survival and success. And there are contemporary examples of this. It's just interesting. There are contemporary examples of this. New Orleans collapsed. New Orleans was a failed society as far as I'm concerned. Now, it's somewhat revived, but not the New Orleans that was there. And it failed because the society did not rally. There was no social solidarity. And that's why it's a failed state. But there are other cases, similar cases, where the people all came together in the face of adversity and survived. So that is the clue: social solidarity in the face of adversity. And that's what we have to promote, and it has to go across all of these lines. That's why I emphasize that climate change is going to make that harder, because people who are already divided are going to be further divided. Hence, working across those lines is absolutely crucial. And there is discussion of that in the IPCC report. Very good question you raise, and it's going to make me think more about that. I'm saying that societies like the Mayans collapsed because the elites insisted on perpetuating their privileged lifestyle at the expense of the rest of the population. They went on building palaces through deforestation, by fighting wars for glory, even as conditions were deteriorating, rather than altering their behavior and working with the poor people and the peasants in their society to adapt to changing climate conditions. And the same thing happened to the Anasazi. So if you have societies where the elites or the ruling class or whatever you want to call them act for their own self-interest at the expense of everybody else, what that typically leads to is revolt, internal civil warfare, and collapse. The societies that succeeded, that Jared Diamond talks about, Tikopia, the New Guinea Highlands, are places where the elites collaborated with everybody else to adopt measures in which nobody was privileged and everybody shared in the hardship, but they survived. That's a sign of hope. Jared Diamond has written a book, the same Jared Diamond has written a book about what we could learn from indigenous peoples around the world. And Naomi Klein, in her book, has highlighted the leadership role that Native societies in the U.S. and Canada have played in fighting against the worst effects of climate change.
The last question in this exchange about the work of Jared Diamond came from someone who suggested that a benevolent dictator might be needed to rescue a society from collapse. Michael Clare.
Yeah, well, I've just read the Japan chapter for the umpteenth time a week ago, so it was a top-down case. This is the Tokugawa period of Japan from the 1600s to about 1850. That was a top-down rule, but it was a rule in which there was a high degree of social cohesion because everybody within that society was guaranteed the minimum requirements to have an adequate lifestyle. So you didn't have and it prohibited elites, including the shogun, from excessive consumption. There were limits on consumption. So yes, it was dictatorial, but it was not in the interests of excessive consumption by elites. So whether that can be replicated or not, I'm not sure. But you're right, this is something that we have to think about.
That is Professor Michael Clare. The last question of the evening for him was directly from the heart and mind of Chicago Area Peace Action. Will climate change bring about world wars among the major powers?
I've trying to think about that a lot. So that's a very good question. Will countries go to war in a world of 2050, in a climate-ravaged world? My feeling is that the risk of that is low, partly because the military forces that they would usually have at their disposal to fight wars somewhere else are all going to be repurposed for humanitarian rescue, for crisis relief, and to protect borders against masses of migrants, and to maintain order in countries that are going to face collapse and disintegration. So, you know, you're not going to have mass armies available and the money to pay for them to go to war on a large scale. That's my suspicion. Now, there are some caveats to that, but I don't know how far down the path of gloomy thinking you want me to go. I highlighted water as a crucial issue in all of this, and I do worry about wars over water. Between India and China, for example, over the headwaters of the rivers that they share is a possibility. There are other places where Egypt might go to war. They've threatened to go to war with Ethiopia, is now building a dam that would divert water from the Nile. So I do worry about wars over water, but those are what I call resource wars. But the other kind of wars, I'm not so sure. But we're guessing. You know, in the current crisis in Europe, what are they talking about? They're talking about using their navy to stop people from crossing the Mediterranean and using their troops to keep people from crossing from Turkey into Greece. That's the future. But they won't have armies available for, international adventures.
And on that note, the organizer of the annual dinner of Peace Action brought the evening to a close.
I want to thank Michael. We can go on.
Thank you. Thank you.
That was Professor Michael Clare. He's five college professor of peace and world security studies and a prolific author. The titles of just the last three of his books are Resource Wars, Blood and Oil, and The Race for What's Left. Michael Clare was recorded by Dale Lehman on October 24, 2015, in Chicago. Peace Action is a peace organization formed through the merger of SANE, the Committee for SANE Nuclear Policy, and the FREEZE, the Nuclear Freeze Campaign. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening.